You're listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good evening. My name is Aryeh Nair. I'm president of the Open Society Foundations, and I'm very pleased to welcome you here this evening. We're going to talk about Lawrence Weschler's new book, Uncanny Valley, Adventures in the Narrative. We're not going to talk about all of the book. Lawrence Weschler writes about politics, he writes about art, he writes about human rights, and he writes about a number of subjects that are not easy to fit into categories. This evening, we're going to focus on the portion of his book that deals with human rights. Lawrence Weschler is a prolific writer, a very graceful writer who has published many books. He was formerly a staff writer for The New Yorker, and he is the executive director of the New York Institute for the Humanities at New York University. And we are joined by another outstanding writer, Tina Rosenberg, who also has written extensively about human rights. She has published a number of books, including The Haunted Land, which won the Pulitzer Prize, and her most recent book is Join the Club. Tina is a writer for the New York Times Magazine and has previously served as a member of the New York Times editorial board. And the way in which we're going to proceed is Lawrence Weschler is going to begin, and then Tina and I will engage in a conversation with Ren Weschler. So, Ren.
Thank you so much, Aryeh. I thought what I might do is just give a little outline of this particular section of the book, which I call Some Probes into the Terrain of Human Rights. And it begins actually with an event that I think you might have been involved with in those days at Human Rights Watch back in your Human Rights Watch days. Richard Avedon and I had been talking for some time about how we could do a project together around human rights. He was very seized by the subject, and it happened that Human Rights Watch was having a one of their annual galas. But in this particular case, they'd invited. It was the 45th, it was the year of the 45th anniversary of the Declaration of Human Rights. So it was 1993.
Which was the year that I left Human Rights Watch to come here.
So it was right at that point. And Human Rights Watch had invited 10 monitors from all over the world, people who were right on the front lines, somebody from Egypt and Zimbabwe and the Philippines and Russia and Venezuela and Colombia and Cambodia and the West Bank and South Africa and Rwanda. And so I arranged eventually just to bring a little a van full of them over to Dick Avedon's studio. It was quite remarkable to watch him in action. I mean, he didn't have any particular idea what he was going to do, and he very quickly set up a kind of bleacher, like a high school bleacher kind of thing. And then he had them standing, and he would bring one forward and photograph the one against the others as backdrop, and as with just the visual metaphor of having their back. And so once he had done that, I wrote something, and I thought maybe I'd start by just reading a bit of that, if that's okay. And I called it Centuries, based on a poem by Thomas Tranströmer, who even back in those days, I kept on every year wishing he would win the Nobel Prize, and highly did. And this is I really, really commend this poem to you if you get a chance. It's a poem called Sentry Duty, sometimes translated as Guard Duty. and it takes as its occasion the fact that apparently in Sweden people, men had to serve a year conscription in the army, guarding the Finnish border or something. I'm not sure what. And he tells a poem about being on night duty, guarding who knows what. And at one point in the poem, he has the lines, task to be where I am, even in this solemn and absurd role, I am still the place where creation does a little work on itself. And I'll start showing some of the pictures as I'm doing this, I guess. Let's see. Tyrannies all over the world exist in the ironclad certainty that people are nothing more than meat on sticks. Anything that their subjects are or have beyond that exists at the sheerest whim of the regime. Indeed, the notion that human beings have absolute rights simply by virtue of their humanity, the right, for instance, not to be tortured, arises initially as a wild, untethered assertion in the face of eons of stark evidence to the contrary, but is a magical assertion. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The truly revolutionary insight in that declaration is contained not so much in the words truths, self-evident, or created equal, as in the calm self-certainty of those opening words, we hold. The text does not launch out with it is manifestly self-evident that, or with some similar construction, as strict logic might seem to dictate. In fact, the self-evidence of the assertion remains hidden, fugitive, imminent at best, until people rise up to embrace it, to hold fast to its insistence, mutually pledging their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor in the process. It is holding such truths to be self-evident that first makes them so, and more specifically doing so in concert alongside others. 45 years ago last month, the members of the General Assembly of the United Nations adopted and proclaimed a Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Most of that organization's member states, however, instantly took to dismissing the document's ringing assertions as so many dead words. And it was left to the individual citizens in those states, often through public stands of almost preposterous courage, to realize the declaration's most basic premises. Theirs is a labor that remains far short of completion, of course. But fundamental to that work, the foundation on which everything else has risen, has been that simple, endlessly repeated act of bearing witness, of compiling accurate and reliable information on the fate of the victims of the human rights depredations of those renegade regimes. Such monitoring usually has had to take place in the very midst of those depredations, and it is almost always very dangerous work. And I go on to describe how the Human Rights Watch movement brings them occasionally to New York, brings them together, and that they had originally offered to bring 12 of them. Two of them, a Chinese and a Syrian at that time, were both in prison and were not allowed to come. I'll just show you something else. All the monitors have their stories. Rwanda's Monique Mujawamariya, and I should say this is December 1993, so this is 4 months before the horrors began in Rwanda, the ones we know about today. All the monitors have their stories. Rwanda's Monique Mujawamariya is typical of those of this year's crew. Trained as a social worker, she helped found and now directs an organization that has been painstakingly documenting a pattern of government-sponsored atrocity and slaughter across her small East Central African homeland. When members of the Human Rights Watch team visited the country, she led them directly to a recent massacre site. Later, when the delegation was at the airport preparing to leave, one of its members saw her being pulled away aside by the regime's chief torturer. Subsequently reaching her by telephone, the Human Rights Watch people asked her what he had wanted. Oh, he just said that if he sees his name in your report, he's going to have me killed, she told them. This is no idle threat. Her face already bears the scars of a car, quote, accident, unquote. Understandably alarmed, they asked her what they ought to do. Why, print it, of course, Mujawa Admaria replied, without a moment's hesitation, and they did. Such bravado ought not to work. How can it? How can mere vigilance, the puny insistence on the rule of law in the face of armored, historically entrenched tyranny, ever make any difference? We hold these truths and nothing else. Aside from them, we are naked before power. Nothing is there except the bold, scary insistence that something is there, this inevitable but essential thing called human rights. And yet, when enough people start insisting forcefully enough on those rights, then over time, a light does begin to shine in the midst of the dark, a substantial light that not only illumines, but actually begins to melt tyrannies. It's uncanny. But what should be clear about the nature of that light, the Bible notwithstanding, the truth by itself never made anyone free. It has always been people, centuries like these, witnessing and declaring the truth, who work that magic. And then indeed, three or four months later, the horrors of Rwanda began, and she, Monique, was one of the first people who was in extreme danger. She was at the top of the list that the regime was going to go after, and there began this incredibly gripping saga where Alison DeForge, who was Human Rights Watch's Rwanda person in New York, was desperately trying to find Monique, get her out. There were tremendous problems, and I ended up writing a piece a few months later in which you took this picture, which had been one of 10, and we made it much bigger and told her story. And indeed, she managed to evade capture, partly, as you can see, a rather large woman, by staying in the rafters of the ceiling of her home as it was ransacked, and staying up there for something like 2 days, and eventually somehow making it out, and then through incredible, you know, hair-raising, and often seemingly failed efforts, they managed to get her, and suddenly she was in Brussels, and then came to New York and was very important in deliberations here. Tragically, Alison DeForge, who's the hero of that story, had done incredibly brave and preposterously courageous things, as many of you know. Died ridiculously in that Buffalo, plane crash outside Buffalo on a stormy night that turned out to be caused because the crew had been awake for 36 hours or some crazy thing because of terrible deregulation of this stuff. Anyway, and indeed, parenthetically, the prize that now honors these monitors each year is called the Alison DeForge Prize. Anyway, so I tell that story, and then just, I thought I'd add a little bit more, and then we can talk. I go on to, a little bit later, to tell the story of the creation of the International Criminal Court. This book, I think of this book as kind of the companion volume to an earlier volume of mine called Vermeer in Bosnia, where I'd, among other things, done some stuff about the Hague Tribunal. And then I was very eager to see when the Yugoslav and Rwanda tribunals were being used as model for what was going to become the International Court and put together by the Treaty of Rome. And so I was there, and I was watching, this is under Clinton's administration, I was watching David Sheffer, who was the Clinton human rights person. And it was just the most astonishing thing to watch, because you had people from well over 100 nations gathered together, trying to cobble together this law, this treaty, and at every corner, the United States was blocking things over and over again, and finding itself in very small alliances with tyrants, because the most important thing on his brief, on Sheffer's brief, was that there should never, ever, under any circumstances, come a point where an American could be brought before such a court. And in order to make that possible, they had on some votes to ally themselves with Zimbabwe, with Libya, with so forth. They were incredibly cynical things, and yet it was quite remarkable to watch a treaty that days before the deadline was to approach looked like it was dead, and suddenly it began to come together, and so I tell this whole story. And in the coda, Sheffer comes back to the United States, and although he had been completely isolated and really people were more and more angry at him, my favorite line about him was, good instincts, terrible instructions. And he was constantly having to take these terrible positions. But he comes back to the United States, and he's greeted as a hero in the United States. So I'll just read you some of the ending.
Should say who greeted him as a hero.
Well, I'm going. It's good. That's going to be here. You watch. Yeah, you weren't there at the greedy line, but I'll just lead into that here. But it occurred to me how surely the siege by this independent prosecutor. All this was parenthetically happening during the Ken Starr regime. Actually, one of the things I say. I should go a little bit earlier. So I tell this incredibly exciting story, and this amazing ovation, and this thing is happening, and it was an incredibly powerful moment of international thing when the actual treaty is being acclaimed. Today, for the first time in history, Forrest Sawyer, sitting in for Peter Jennings, led that evening's ABC World News Tonight, just a few hours later in New York Times. A Secret Service agent testified before a grand jury as part of a criminal investigation of a sitting U.S. president. And this was not mentioned on any U.S. newscast. The U.S. newscasts were completely obsessed with Ken Starr and with Monica Lewinsky and so forth at that point. It occurred to me how surely the siege by this independent prosecutor must have been coloring President Clinton's own responses to the developments in Rome, leaving him especially wary at that very moment of the toughest decisions, toughest decisions were having to be made. On the other hand, surely there was more to it than that. At various times there in the halls of Rome, various people would invoke the League of Nations. If the U.S. walks out of this court, the Syrian delegate assured me, his eyes twinkling with grim satisfaction. He was all for it. He could hardly wait. It will be like the League of Nations. Perhaps I remember thinking, but in that case, ought President Clinton be cast in the role of Woodrow Wilson or that of Henry Cabot Lodge? Of course, the answer in retrospect is both. With regard to the court, Clinton wanted to play both Wilson and Lodge, and not half and half, not a wily Wilson disguising himself as a grimly realistic Lodge or vice versa. Rather, Whitman-esque, Clinton wanted to contain multitudes. He saw no contradiction in being both Wilson and Lodge, each 100% and both simultaneously, which is to say that he was approaching the international court in much the same way he'd approached just about everything else in his administration. Gays in the military, national health insurance, campaign finance reform, landmines, Bosnia, global warming, etc. And then, less than a week later, on Thursday, July 23rd, back in Washington, D.C., David Sheffer was called to appear before Jesse Helms' Senate Committee on Foreign Relations. He might have been accused of a certain feeling of conceptual whiplash. For if he was being treated by the end there in Rome as a sort of pariah or leper, now, back in Washington, he was being unanimously praised as a kind of returning hero. Positions that had provoked nary a chord of resonance in the conference hall in Rome were almost drowned in a rising chorus of defiant triumphalism on Capitol Hill. Senators Helms, Rod Grams, Joseph Biden, and Dianne Feinstein each addressed Sheffer in turn, congratulating him on the fortitude of his resolve and pledging their undying contempt for that monstrosity spawned in Rome. Not one of them mentioned Bosnia or Rwanda or Pol Pot or Idi Amin or the Holocaust or Nuremberg. Senator Feinstein did wonder about the possible implications for Israel. They all seemed utterly and almost uniquely transfixed by the treaty's exposure implications for American troops, vowing to protect them and to fight it. And it gradually becomes clear that they don't care about the American troops, which was always the thing that was being raised in Rome, but about Kissinger and American leaders and what their exposure might be. Let's see here. Helms picked off the examples defiantly. He was going to be damned if any so-called international court was ever going to be reviewing the legality of the U.S. invasion of Panama or Grenada or the bombing of Tripoli and holding any American president or secretary of state, defense secretary, or general to account. He said it in so many words, Senator Helms did. I've been accused by advocates of this court of engaging in 18th century thinking, Chairman Helms concluded his statement. Well, I find that to be a compliment. It was the 18th century that gave us our Constitution and the fundamental protections of the Bill of Rights. I'll gladly stand with James Madison and the rest of our founding fathers over that collection of ne'er-do-wells in Rome any day. At some level, of course, Helms was way off the mark in his choice and characterization of antecedents. James Madison, for one thing, was a Federalist, with Hamilton the principal authorist of the Federalist Papers, and as such ranged himself passionately against the nativist self-states rightsers of his day, and in favor of a wider conception of governance. But at the same time, it seemed to me that Helms was onto something. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. Thomas Jefferson strikingly pitched his Declaration of Independence in an assertion of universal human values, an assertion that cascading down through the ages from the Declaration of the Rights of Man in 1789 through the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948 constitutes one of the principal wellsprings of the law feeding into the International Criminal Court. But at the same time, Jefferson cast those assertions in what was, after all, a declaration of independence, of separateness, of American exceptionalism, stirring defiant themes that had been very well in evidence there in Rome as well. Anyway, I go on. There's a couple other pieces which maybe we'll come to as we're talking about it. One about an exhibit of the art of the disappeared, South American artist dealing with the legacy of the terrible dirty wars, exhibit put together by a curator in North Dakota, of all places. And then finally, a piece I wrote about a mini nervous breakdown I had at the Eisenman War Memorial, memorial in Berlin to the murdered Jews, and we can talk about that too. But maybe I'll stop there. And
okay. Tina, your reflections or comments or questions?
Yes. Well, Wren, first of all, I'd like to say that this is an extraordinary book, like most of Wren's writing. The different themes in it are so fascinating, and the way they link together. And it's really, in many ways, your subject is always perception. And he uses that in art, and he uses that in politics. But it's really a wonderful, very provocative, interesting book and I highly recommend it. I wanted to talk about the other two pieces, ones you just briefly mentioned, if that's okay. The one called Gazing Back, which was about the art exhibition. Maybe you can show that picture of the limestone of about the Argentine disappeared.
Let's see. This one here.
This is an amazing. You go up to it and you.
It's on video. It's video.
Okay. It's a video of
a
person.
It's by a man named Oscar Munoz, and you see the hand.
Writing with a hand with water on limestone. And he draws a face. And then you watch as it disappears over the course of about a minute.
And then there's another, there are altogether five HD screens. And then he moves his hand to another one. And gradually they disappear.
It's really wonderful.
At first you don't, it looks like white paper at first, and it looks like black ink, but then you gradually realize it must be hot cement or hot limestone, whatever. And the last thing that lasts, as each of them disappears, are the eyes. And so eventually there's just these two, and then they disappear, and then he's on to another one. But,
but that piece and the piece... Berlin Epiphanies about the memorial to the murdered Jews. And what's interesting to me is that they have in common you're wrestling with the idea of civic normality and how much is it legitimate for normal life to go on after massive violations of human rights like this.
Right.
And that got me, and you're of two minds of this, right? I mean, you sort of haven't made up your mind about it.
As I said at one point, I am adamantly of two minds.
Adamantly of two minds, right. That got me thinking about the idea of civic normality, not after massive violations of human rights, but during massive violations of human rights. And I think that this is a very key point, and it's what in authoritarian countries allows these violations to go on, because what the government wants in an authoritarian country is for everyone to retreat into their own private life. And if the government can accomplish that, then it will stay in power, no matter pretty much what else it does. And at first, really, this really hit me in the gut when I arrived in Chile for the first time in 1986. It was the middle of the start of the serious protest movement, the second wave of it, but the one that eventually was successful, a mere 13 years after Pinochet came to power. And I got to Santiago, and it was around midday, and I looked around and I said, where are the soldiers? Because people were eating ice cream, and people were sitting and getting their shoes shined and reading the newspaper, and people were walking into the shops and you know, buying meat for dinner, and kids were coming out of school in their uniforms. This is not what I expected. It's certainly not what I saw from watching the news internationally, where all you saw were the protests, of course. And then I realized that is how Pinochet kept himself in power. I mean, in the first 3 years of the regime, from 1973 to 1976, when there were 3,000 people killed or disappeared, and then actually till 1983, there was very little attention to this from Chile as a whole. Very, very little attention. I mean, he had basically killed or disappeared all the most serious activists, and the rest of them were intimidated into silence. But what he did was make people's private life very successful because of economic policies that crashed later and exchange rate policies. Cheap imports were flooding Chile, and you could buy a color TV on credit very easily. You could buy an imported car on credit. And people were thrilled about this. And even people who had been very strong partisans and activists in the Allende years, pro-Allende, all of a sudden just sort of shut down that side of themselves and said, I'm going to enjoy life. And that was very important. There were really no protests in Chile until 1983. What happened in 1983? The economy crashed. And all of a sudden everyone woke up and said, oh, there's human rights violations going on here. But they hadn't noticed it because they were too involved in this brilliantly created civic normality. And I just want to tell one story of how powerful that can be. And this was told to me by a man named Orlando Saenz, who had been early on in the Pinochet regime, the Minister of Economics, I think. And he had left. He became an opponent of Pinochet later on. And he told me the story about a woman who came up to him who was a good friend of his. She was working for the regime in New York at the United Nations, and she said, Orlando, you've just gotten hoodwinked. There is no such thing as human rights violations. You've been duped. This is just an argument by the left. Nobody in this country is murdered, and nobody in this country is tortured by the government. And he thought about this for a second, and he said, let me tell you a story. He said, when I was a minister in the government, a good friend of mine came to me and told me that her sister had been taken away. Could I find her? Could I find out what happened to the sister? And he said, it was risky for me, but I did it. I investigated. I found out that the sister was alive, was being held in a certain prison, and I made it possible for my friend to visit her sister. And at this point, the woman was crying. And he said, and I'm surprised that you've forgotten that, because that was you. And it was her sister. And she said, you're not going to believe me, but I have forgotten. I had forgotten. These years have been so good to me that I've just blocked that part out of my memory. I'm not certain I believe this story. I think I do.
You're not certain you believe him or her?
Well, both.
Yeah.
I mean, I believe that at the time he told it to me, and then later on I thought about it, I said, this is so extreme, it can't possibly be true. Do you believe it?
Well, it reminds me, I often think about this in the context of Sartre writing Being in Nothingness, and he's writing it during Nazi occupation. He's in an amphetamine haze, parenthetically, and part of which accounts for my friend Oliver Sacks, his copy of Being in Nothingness. There are parts of the writing that are so impossible to read that you can't stand, and then there are moments of just incredible lucidity. And Oliver has gone through like an FBI file and not underlined the parts he likes, but with a black, thick felt pen just blocked out entire sections so that they'll never be seen again. But in one of the great sections, and think about this being written during at that same moment of the occupation, he's talking about bad faith And what does he mean by bad faith? And if you think about it, this is a country in which just to get through the day, you have to collaborate, and you have to tell yourself stories. When I say adventures of the narrative, I'm very interested in stories people tell themselves. And he tells this, when I teach this in class, it's all of his examples are so politically incorrect today, but they're still very interesting. So yeah, at one point he talks about the girl on a date. And he says, there's a girl on a date, and she wants, it's the first date, and she wants to be addressed as a sexual being, but she also doesn't want to be addressed as a sexual being. And they're on the date, and it's reached a certain point, they're sitting on the sand, they've had their dinner, and the man puts his hand on her thigh. And the woman has reached this crisis. Either she's going to push it away or she's going to leave it there. Again, think about this in the context of somebody living through Nazism. You know, either she's going to push it away or he's going to leave it there. And he says, we all know what happens next. She leaves it there, but she doesn't notice that it's there. Because at that moment, her mind is filled with thoughts of posterity, of history, the sky, the stars, the galaxies, endless number of things, and that allows it for a divorce mm-hmm. to take place and to go on. And I think it's absolutely an amazing story. If the sexual politics bothers you, just flip the genders or whatever you want to do. But the point is, of that phenomenon of people who just don't notice, because, you know, I mean, there was that great television set, and there was this, and things seem to be going well, and I would amplify what you're saying is that that in Chile, that it was just a question of primarily of murder and so forth. In Argentina, even more devilishly, it was disappearances, where it really was impossible to find out what had happened, and the regime would not only take people away, torture them, murder them, but would deny having done so, and they would just. They would be disappeared. And as a result, the real activists, not only the activists were taken care of, but their entire families fell into this kind of twilight zone of desperately trying to find information in the very midst of a situation where the rest of the society was feverishly trying to work. Now, one of the things that, in terms of the direct answer to what you're...
I want to tell a story about Chile, which is not quite as dramatic as Tina's story, but it's somewhat along the same lines. My own first visit to Chile was in 1981, and it was December 1981, and I had gone there because there was a non-governmental organization, the Chilean Commission on Human Rights, and they had celebrated Human Rights Day, which is December 10, the anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And at the end of the event, seven persons connected to the Chilean Commission on Human Rights were arrested. And I went a few days later in response to their arrests. Through the connections of one of the officials of the Chilean Commission on Human Rights, who had been a Minister of Education and briefly Foreign Minister during the last Christian Democratic government of Chile under Eduardo Frei, I managed to get into a prison and see three of the people who had been arrested. They had first been held by the Secret Service, and by this point it was about 6 days after they had initially been arrested and they had been transferred to a regular prison. And one of these people who I saw, a man named Pablo Fuenzalida, had been badly tortured. He had been tortured by electric shock at the point that that I saw him, one side of his body was paralyzed on the basis of the electric shock. And after I saw him in the prison, talked to him, I had arranged a meeting with the permanent secretary of the foreign ministry. That is not the foreign minister, but the secretary general of the foreign ministry. And I talked to him about the prisoners I had seen, including the man who had been severely tortured, and you know he was filled with denials of all this, and he said he would get me medical statements that had been taken at the time that they were transferred from the DNI, the secret police, to the regular prison showing, but nothing of this sort could have taken place. At any rate, I went through that meeting. It was only after that that I learned something, and that is that the permanent secretary of the foreign ministry was actually the first cousin of the person I had seen who was tortured. That had never emerged in my conversation with the permanent secretary.
And what do you think? Do you think he believed what he was telling you?
I have no way of knowing what he believed. He did afterwards have medical statements delivered to my hotel. They were one-page typed statements, at the bottom of which there were indecipherable signatures, completely indecipherable, with no typed version of the names.
Well, you know how doctors handwriting is.
Right. but no, but they didn't have any typed version of the name. I actually took the statements then to the medical society in Chile and met with the officials of the medical society, and they told me there wasn't anything they could do about it because the Pinochet regime had stripped the professional associations of their right to discipline their members. Although later on, in fact, you know, after 1986, the medical society became quite active on human rights matters and did, in fact, identify some of the doctors who had examined people as they were being tortured to say whether more torture could take place, and did, in fact, expel a number of these physicians from the medical society. But whether the permanent secretary believed that, I really don't know. I have no way.
Essentially, in terms of both these stories, I'm reminded of the passage just before the passage I referred to in Sartre, where his whole discussion of bad faith begins with a critique of Freud, and Freud's notion of the unconscious. And he says that surely this must be wrong, the notion that you have all kinds of unconscious drives, things that are repressed. The language always is very interesting in terms of the language, of political language, in of the description that it's repressed. There's a censor who keeps it from coming to consciousness and so forth, and they petition to get past consciousness, into consciousness and so forth. And Freud said, this surely must be wrong because and that the theory of neurosis is that these unconscious drives are twisting us because they can't be made conscious. And he said, this surely must be wrong because the censor, at very least, has to be on the side of awareness. Otherwise, it has to know what to censor. Otherwise, it will be completely ineffective. In fact, not only is this stuff known by people who are repressing it, it is at the forefront of their minds in the mode of making sure not to remember it. And that's what neurosis is. That countries live constantly in a frenzy of consumerism, for example, as a way of they just didn't have time to think about it because there were so many other things they were thinking about until you get to this point.
I would certainly not have any problems believing that that the permanent secretary was very sure that his cousin had not been tortured. I mean, especially in Latin America, I mean, the families divided by politics is a venerable tradition. Closer relations than that, I mean, a brother against brother, sons against mothers, it's pretty common. And both sides are firm adherence to whatever propaganda they're being told.
But you could come back to what Ren was saying about David Sheffer, because, you know, it's worth talking about David a little bit. David had been Madeleine Albright's counsel when he was when she was ambassador to the United Nations, and he was sort of her person, and she had appointed him, I think, to the post of ambassador for war crimes. But David had a background in the human rights field, and after having, you know, led the effort to oppose the International Criminal Court, after he left government, in a way he resumed his identification with the human rights movement. He is now a professor of law at Northwestern University. He frequently convenes human rights conferences. He writes extensively in the human rights field. But then he was the ambassador for war crimes in the Clinton administration, and the Clinton administration didn't want to be accused of betraying the country by becoming a party to the International Criminal Court. So, you know, he lobbied there for Security Council agreement to any prosecution by the International Criminal Court, which would have meant that as a permanent member of the Security Council, the United States could have vetoed any prosecution.
And as could Russia or China.
As could Russia or China. Or France in the case of Rwanda,
right. Sure.
Or, you know, France and Britain also have
sure.
their client states. So this would have essentially emasculated the International Criminal Court, and as a human rights advocate or somebody who is known as a human rights advocate, that was the role he played for the United States. And whether that's significantly different, you know, from the Chilean official, you know, I'm not sure.
I remember many conversations, discussions, arguments that I had with David. I think you've all had these same conversations. And what always struck me about him was he never broke. He never acknowledged, you know, in any way that he wasn't saying what he thought. And he would just sort of smile wearily and then repeat the arguments of the administration. And I just kept thinking, how can he stay in this job?
I, as long as we have this up here, I just wanted to show one other that I'm sure you also thought was amazing, which was this one here. It's very hard to realize what's going on in this picture, but I'll try to explain it. This was the grandmothers of the disappeared. So it started as the mothers of the disappeared, but it turned out in Argentina that 30,000 people were disappeared, of whom apparently over 200 were pregnant women at the time of their abduction, who were systematically kept tortured and so forth, but kept alive until they could deliver the babies and then killed. And the babies were given to military families and police families who were having trouble who were having trouble conceiving their own, which is, if you think about it, a double murder. I mean, not only have you killed the daughter, but you, or the father, in the case of the couple being abducted, but you're taking the grandchild and raising them as an enemy of the kind of person who their parents would have been. And so at a certain point, 25 years later, the grandmothers of the disappeared came to this group of artists who were a cooperative called Identity, and said, is there anything you can do to help us? Here's our problem. We figure that the children, our grandchildren, are now turning out to be about the same age that their parents were at the time that they were abducted and killed. And they don't even know who they are. And what we would like to do is find some way of getting to them. And is there some way that art could be brought to bear on this, or something could be done? And they created this incredible piece, which consisted of photos of the father and the mother with a mirror, and the father and the mother and a mirror, And as you went, and by the way, it was like a maze. And so as you went around, first of all, if you weren't the child who disappeared, you just couldn't believe there could be more. There could be more. And you kept on turning the corner. There were more, and there were more. And it just to line up 200 photographs, in this case, it becomes 400 photographs because it's both the father and the mother, is itself a horrifying specific instance. But the hope was that one by one, people would recognize themselves. And the genius of this particular piece, along the lines, by the way, of the question of whether you should remember or forget and so forth, the genius is this is a piece that's designed to disappear, that every time somebody did find themselves, they would remove those and they would collapse everything else. And it is now, several years later, and 10 of the couples have been removed because in 10 cases out of the 200 so far, the children have found themselves and been reunited, which is the beginning of a whole other story, as you can imagine. No, 10 out of the 200 over 200 have found themselves, but the piece is that much smaller, and the hope is that over time, it will disappear completely. So it's quite a powerful piece. But,
If I could ask you something, Bren. You used those Avedon photos at the beginning. I wonder whether you were struck, as I have been struck over time, that it's very difficult to fit the people who engage in this human rights monitoring into any category.
Right, right.
They don't seem to fit. By professional training. I mean, Monique from Rwanda was a social worker.
Right.
And there are social workers who do this. There are lawyers who do this. There are people
who... cooperative people. Hmm? Farmers. Rubber tappers, famously.
All kinds. Yeah. And, one... element that sometimes seems to be present, but it's not that widespread, is that sometimes, a member of their family has been a victim of a human rights abuse. But I'm unable to determine a category which makes people engage in this, quite extraordinary effort to record these abuses, to collect the details, to disseminate the information, and yet without tens of thousands of people in different countries systematically gathering information, the entire human rights effort could not exist. I mean, just one story on that. One of the major efforts I was ever involved in to collect human rights information, it was probably the most extensive effort that I was ever engaged in, was what happened in the Anfal in Iraq. This is the campaign that Saddam Hussein launched in 1988 against the Kurds in northern Iraq. Iraq had been engaged in this 8-year-long war with Iran. And Saddam Hussein thought, probably rightly, that the Kurds were trying to take advantage of the war in order to establish an independent Kurdistan. And so he launched this campaign, which consisted of rounding up Kurdish males and transporting them to a desert location where there were trenches that had been dug, and then they were put into the trenches, machine gunned, and then bulldozers pushed the sand over the people who were pushed into those trenches. And, you know, the estimates are that 80 or 90,000 people were killed in this fashion. And at one point I had an Iraqi visit the offices of Human Rights Watch, and his story was that he was an engineer by training. He had studied in he was Kurdish. He was he had studied in Mosul in Iraq, and to study engineering in Iraq, his courses had been given in English. So. He spoke English quite well. And as all this was taking place, he was aware that people were being rounded up. And he actually walked around Kurdistan, and he collected detailed information on 15,000 persons who had been taken away and had disappeared. And he had made his way out of Iraq. He had gone to London. He had gone to the foreign ministry. He had gone to various embassies. And nobody would believe him. They said he had all these 15,000 names and details on all this, but he said it was impossible that 15,000 people should have disappeared without this becoming known, and therefore it wasn't credible. At that point, we had some other information that something like this had taken place, and we ultimately were able to put him to work for a period of a few years. Helping to document everything that took place. But why does an engineer walk around Kurdistan for the immense amount of time and putting in the immense amount of effort that is required to collect 15,000 stories?
This reminds me of absolutely
incredible. Yeah.
It reminds me of something that happened early on in my tenure at The New Yorker, where it was the 40th anniversary of the Danish rescue of the Jews that had taken place in 1943, so it was 1983, so I'd been at The New Yorker for 2 years, and there was an exhibit about the Danish rescue, which is an amazing story, as some of you may know. I mean, basically, the Danes found out that the Jews were going to be rounded up. They were going to be rounded up late, by the way, in the general order of things, because Germany had wanted to keep Denmark the breadbasket, basically, the creator of milk, or I guess it was mainly milk and cheese and so forth for, throughout the war, and they didn't want to get the Danes upset. But it had been decided they were not going to round up all the Jews, and the word got out, and somehow there was this plan, and it was executed almost flawlessly, in which all the Jews were brought together and overnight taken across to Sweden and rescued. And so there were two of the rescuers. There was a show here in New York. It might have been at the Jewish Museum, I'm not sure, but they had brought over two of the rescuers who at this point were in their 60s. And so I went over and talking to them, and I asked, what is the deal with Denmark? I mean, you're surrounded by all these countries. I mean, Poland, Germany, France, England with, complicated, torturous anti-Semitic traditions, and it doesn't seem to have happened in Denmark. What's the deal? And one of them said to me, I mean, I don't understand your question. Isn't the question, why is there anti-Semitism in all these other places? What kind of question is there, why isn't there anti-Semitism? The code of, which I thought was an amazing answer, and I went, the code of this is I went running back to The New Yorker, and I saw Sean, and I said, the old man, and I said, it's great, this will make a great talk piece, and I really want to write this up. This is what a great answer. This sums up that's the answer right there. And he just frowned and he said, "Oh dear, Mr. Weschel, I'm afraid we can't do that because we've already covered the story of the Danish Jews in Miss Arendt's reporting from the Eichmann trial." which had been like
1961.
1961, like, and you suddenly realize that for William Shaw, that was all just one book he was compiling, and he's already done that. But in turn, that answer, I think there's a little bit of that to it. I mean, one keeps hearing that in terms of people who there are people who just, when pressed, would say that it wasn't courage exactly. It was just that how would you not act? Why wasn't everybody else acting that way? But that only begs the question. But I think it is part of the answer. I mean, what is common with all these people? I mean, you've met these monitors over the years, and they will all tell you. I mean, if you and I'm sure you've asked that question, and the answer you get is a variation on that. Like, it's self-evident that you would do it. Which by the way, comes back to that thing I was saying about the self-evident, we hold these truths to be self-evident. I mean, maybe another way of putting it is the we who do hold these truths to be self-evident are this kind of strange group initially for whom it is self-evident, when it's obviously not self-evident, apparently, for most people. Does that make any sense?
Why don't we open it up for anybody who wants to ask a question, and if you do so, you should be aware that you're being recorded if you ask a question. So if you go to the mic, anybody who wants to. If not, we'll just keep on here.
If you don't interrupt us, nothing can stop us.
All right, I'll interrupt you. Yeah. I'm Carol Schlitt. I had worked here with the National Security and Human Rights Campaign of the U.S. programs, and now working as a consultant, and was a human rights monitor in Haiti and in Bosnia. And I was really struck by your discussion of how impactful and important these arts and culture strategies are in conveying to people what sometimes doesn't come across in the legal strategies and in the cases, but through these photographs, through these disappearing pictures, videos, recently in documentary film, for example. I think of this film that I saw recently about the Holocaust, Sophie's Key, which talks about what happened in France, while in the midst of what, as Tina was talking about, this sort of normalcy in Paris as people were being rounded up in the middle of Paris. I just wanted for you to talk a little bit more specifically about the importance of using art, using culture, using this kind of strategy, and how, you know, foundations can encourage that work more and more to get across the point about human rights.
It'll be good to hear Tina's answer to this too.
Yes.
I mean, I've often found, and this comes back to the notion of narrative, which is the thread that runs all through this. The way in which we respond to stories or to being faced by faces and the stories that rise up with us inside of us when we're faced by faces, let's say. But it's always struck me that a lot of my, on the human rights side of my work, I was invariably using material from Human Rights Watch and Amnesty and so forth, but that material is often necessarily dry. And the law is often necessarily dry, and that's what makes it effective at some level. But both on my own part, my job is I always felt was to find a way of gripping the reader, and especially when Tina's one of the masters of this. Is finding some way past the defenses, because people don't want to know this stuff. I remember during one of my other books, Miracle Universe, I mean, at that time, it was in the middle of the Reagan years, we were deeply implicated in torture as a society. It's always amazing how many times America can lose its innocence, you know, of Abu Ghraib. Where did that come? How could Americans be involved in this? Hello, where have you been? But the question was, how did we, in that particular moment, how do you get people to read about this stuff going on in Latin America and our involvement in it? And it happened that I came upon two stories at that time which were kind of human rights caper stories. I mean, they were adventure stories of human rights victims getting even with their torturers in a nonviolent way. And it was just the the thrall of the story, the narrative. And oddly enough, in one of the cases, it was the thrall of the story of how a relatively dry account in Brazil had been put together. The account itself was overwhelmingly powerful when read cumulatively, but not itself a great story. And then a really amazing story was the story of how this thing had even come into existence. In the same way that Avedon had the insight that, you know, taking those pictures and, you know, you have to find, it seems to me that it's the job of writers, artists, and so forth to wake people up to how they're sleepwalking, as I say in one of the pieces. And to do that, we need all the information that Human Rights Watch and so forth provide, but we have to do a little alchemy on it to bring it to life. Does that make sense to you?
I understand what you're saying, and I used to agree with it.
Oh, dear. See, now. Okay.
But now I'm going to be a grouch.
Okay, great. Grouch,
which is that I think when you're talking about the power of art, you fall into the danger of reaching a very small circle of people. I mean, this extraordinary show out of North Dakota, I doubt anyone saw it who wasn't already predisposed to accept everything it said as truth. I mean, nobody would wander in there and say, oh my God, look at what was happening in Argentina and I didn't know about it. I think that you can sift through history and think about what is it that actually reaches the people you need to reach, who are not the folks who are already convinced. And there's precious few things, and they don't really have much to do with what we do, unfortunately. I think that, for example, in Chile, the consensus shifted among the right that, okay, Pinochet was a bad guy, because evidence came out, incontrovertible evidence about corruption, not about human rights violations. And that was what broke people's, his supporters. That was the first crack in the mask. And then it expanded. I think that in South Africa, for example, one of the things that was the most powerful about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, to me, what made it effective was that it used basically game theory to get people to confess. You confess on national television, and we won't put you in jail. And so people confess.
If you don't, and we find out about you, we will.
Well, we will try, and we'll spend a lot of money to try, but chances are we won't be able to do it. So what happened was that supporters of the regime got to hear from the mouths of the people who committed the crimes exactly what happened. That was pretty damn convincing. That is what I think is required to shift the way a country perceives its past. And I don't really think art has that much to contribute.
What about reportage?
If you're televising the confessions of former torturers, that's useful. If you can write about it in a way that reaches people who would be shocked by it, that's useful.
In my New Yorker coverage and your New York Times coverage, do you think you ever, in large numbers, got to people who didn't already agree with you?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer. Do you?
I think what you and I do is, it's capillary action. I mean, it's not arterial in some way, but one of the things we do is provide stuff that other people can talk to, other people can talk to other people, and it does filter down a bit at some point, one hopes.
In South Africa, I was thinking of the reporting that Joe Lelieveld did in the New York Times at the time that Steve Biko was murdered. And I think that, a good part of the sort of focus on apartheid in the United States, which ultimately led to the disinvestment campaign and the effort to promote sanctions, started with the reporting on the Biko murder. That Lelyveld, talked about the love story between Steve Biko and Mampela Ramphele, and he did humanize what had transpired, and the account of the inquest and the behavior of the police, that was first-rate reporting. And I thought then, and I think now, that it did play a very significant role. I think that when there has been first-rate reporting, look, thinking back in the United States, if you think of the civil rights movement, starting with the Montgomery bus boycott, and then the sit-in demonstrations, the freedom rides, and so forth. There were a handful of journalists, Calvin Trillin in The New Yorker, and Claude Sitton for the New York Times, and Jack Nelson for the Los Angeles Times, and a few others who covered the civil rights movement in a way that made it a dramatic thing for people outside the South, and I think of journalism that really played a significant role in rights issues as really having originated in the United States. With the reporting on the civil rights movement.
It reminds me of something I just saw a couple weeks ago. If any of you are going to Los Angeles during the next period, as part of the Pacific Standard Time, all the museums in L.A. are doing things about L.A. art, and the L.A. County Museum has put back together for the first time in over 35 years Ed Kienholz's absolutely astonishing assemblage or tableau called Five Car Stud, and this is directly related to what you were asking a second ago. And you go into this dark hangar-like space, probably twice the size of this room, and it's five kind of disembodied cars with their lights facing together. And then he has those figures that Kienholz would do, which were kind of made out of casts of people and so forth. And it's five guys have arrived. There's one car off to the side. Inside the car, there is a. And you walk, by the way, you walk around this. It's a kind of dusty. It's dirt on the ground, and you walk around, and you begin to notice. And inside one car, there's a man with his hand over, holding a gun, and he's got his arm over the door. And inside the car is a woman who's just basically retching. She's horrified, and the rest of the men are all gathered around and holding. Down a black man and four men pulling from force. They have him quartered on ropes, and the other man is basically castrating him. And clearly, what has happened is that there was this couple, this white man, the woman, and this black man were having beer or whatever, and they'd arrived and they were doing this. And it's absolutely astonishing. And by the way, in one of the cars, there's a 10-year-old boy who's inside the car looking out, and you only notice that after a while and seeing this. And it's just quite overpowering thing. First of all, it's not true that it's only people who already know it who see it. I mean, people just walking through their day come upon it. But the thing that to me was the most powerful as a work of art was that damn dirt. You got it on your feet, on your shoes. And beyond that, one of the effects was in this desolate, faraway place that that it was a secret place. It was off, way off the side of the road, and so forth. In fact, you see thousands and thousands and thousands of footprints all around it. So it's incredibly populated by. it has a little bit of the same effect that, that the Vietnam War Memorial does when you stand and you see all the names, and through the names you see the throngs of people who look initially like the dead looking at back at us, then you realize it's us looking at them, and that kind of wonderful effect that happens there. But it occurred to me, as I saw it, that the place it needs to be is this new museum in that Walton, the Walton era, is putting up in Arkansas. I don't know, there's this incredible, there was a huge ad in the New York Times just the other day that, that the greatest new museum in America, and it is, by the way, they've spent, this. The one of the Walton heirs has spent hundreds of millions of dollars putting together this collection that's going to be in the middle of Arkansas, and it will become a destination to go there. But it occurred to me that, you know, this would be an amazing piece to put there, you know, just have as it is. I'd go even further and say that it's not, you're not just preaching to the converted, but you're doing something to the people who already agree with you. That matters too.
Well, that does matter, and what Aria was talking about reaching third-party outsiders who can have some influence on a situation or who are related but more indirect, I think that also does matter. But I don't think that the hardcore people, I don't think that you're going to change their minds.
There's a passage. By the way, are there going to be other questions? Because we shouldn't monopolize this, but let me just read.
I think what we can do is, you know, we're running late.
Okay,
we said we'd end at 7:30, but let's go just take another question.
Okay.
And go ahead.
Hi. excuse me. I'm Taylor Krauss. I work in Rwanda, filming video testimonies of survivors in Rwanda. And my question is related to this whole conversation, and particularly maybe to the 10-year-old boy in that exhibit. I find with the conversation about preaching to the choir, or the conversation about the very choir that you're speaking to, what's actually happening in that consciousness and with that 10-year-old boy? And what is, among the three of you, your own sort of fascination or obsession with the looking, which is to say that you've talked about people who look away and are able to put that sensor in their mind at the, and that's sort of a normalcy, and you've raised the issue of the human rights advocates or activists in the field who are documenting, but what is your own obsession in your work or your own journey with this looking, and why look?
In a way, this relates to the very last piece, the Berlin piece, and I'll just show you some pictures in terms of the crisis I had. Basically, there's this incredible monument that Eisenman, with great solemnity, has put together. I think I have it here. You know, it's just 1,000 plinths, you know, of raising and so forth, and it ought to work. It ought to be an incredible place. You can go into it and you're lost, and just this incredible sense of the horror of it. But what's happened is that it's become a makeout place for teenagers. And it's a fantastic place to play around. And of course it is. How could it not be? And so I was seeing this and you know, this kind of thing and that kind of thing. And I would suddenly say, oh, this is horrible, you know, this is monstrous, this is, and then I kind of said, or maybe it's not. I mean, and coming back to the 10-year-old boy, and especially the 10-year-old boys you're facing in Rwanda, give them a break. You know, at some level, they do need, the place does need to be a playground again, and that's the, of two minds that I am. And the way it plays out in my writing, parenthetically, I used to say at the New Yorker that I would go back and forth between political tragedies and cultural comedies. And I would, you know, I would, you know, do torture in Latin America, and then I'd be doing this artist who draws money and spends his drawings, you know, and it wasn't only to keep from going crazy. But the key thing in the Vermeer and Bosnia piece was I was asking Antonio Cassese, who just died a few weeks ago, the head judge in the Yugoslav War Crimes Tribunal, what kept him from going crazy. And he said as often as possible he went to look at the Vermeers at the Mauritshuis, you know, and that began that whole little mind walk. But you know, so in my own life, I try very consciously to vary it, and also so that when I come back to doing a piece of reportage of really horrible stuff, that it's that I haven't numbed myself to it in some way. In that piece there, it ends with this great poem of Szymborska's about reality demands. Reality demands that we also remember this life goes on. That it goes on. She has this great line that it goes on. I can't find it right, but that she has this great line that letters travel every day between Pearl Harbor and Hastings. That there's a gas station and so on. And then she eventually has that there are little boys with a stalk of grass in their mouth looking up at the sky. You know, who didn't know, and so forth. And at the end of the day, it's worth remembering that the whole reason we do all this is so that there can be that world too. And that at the end of the day, it seems to me that it is the existence of that quotidian, stupid, silly world that is the wellspring from out of which, you know, maybe at the end of the day you can confront the horrors. But I'm very much of two minds, and so I'm not quite sure whether this is a good thing. But I think it is. I actually think it is.
I was just wondering whether Pam and Paco had anything to say about this.
About art?
Well, about the role that you play when you
describe who they are.
They are filmmakers. Granito is the most recent.
Well, I was thinking about it when you were talking because you feel.
Okay, here we go.
I can't tell you how many times at screenings of our films the answer is from people who actually I don't think were the choir, so to speak. I don't think, maybe because it's film and oftentimes it's in festivals when we first launch the film, people come out of curiosity. A lot of times we get comments like, I had no idea about what happened in Guatemala. No idea. And they leave with this feeling that I don't know if they're going to do something or not. Or I've heard actually people say Miracle Universe put them on a certain track in their life. We've heard that with our films too, oftentimes years later. So I think that sometimes you affect people at key moments in their lives, and maybe it's ultimately a handful out of humanity. But that handful.
By the way, in that particular case. That show in North Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
One day I get this email: would I please come and talk at the opening of this show about the situation that disappeared at the North Dakota Museum of Art? And you know, I said, "What? This can't. This is not going to be any good." But I always go where I've never been before, so I went, and it was an incredible show. And it turned out that this woman, who doesn't speak Spanish, Laurel Reuter, incredible curator. But she got it onto the scene because of a Miracle Universe. She'd read those pieces and it got her going down to Spain, down to Latin America for 10 years doing this.
There you go. And I saw the show here in New York.
So it does well out. You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think also that art, especially in the case of film, I mean, it's a contributing factor. If you look at social change and you look at human rights defense, there are so many things that go into it. And what is going to create or contribute to a tipping point? Okay, in the last 5 months in Guatemala, more people have been arrested and convicted for crimes committed in the 1980s than in the previous 30 years. You know, two former generals have been arrested and charged with genocide. Three special forces caviles have been convicted and sentenced to 6,060 years. For 30 years for each of the 201 civilians that they killed in the Dos Erres massacres. So the films can be part of this mix that's pushing things forward. Sometimes there's a decisive factor that you can point to, and sometimes it's so many contributing factors. That's the whole concept behind Granito de Arena.
And if I could say, you know, at Human Rights Watch, and you talk about the sort of, in a way, the dreariness of human rights reports.
Well, I said dryness. I didn't say dreary.
Okay, dry, if you will. But the dreariness, you know, was intentional.
I know. I said it was.
It was because you were dealing with all these sensational matters, and you wanted to avoid in any way a sensational style in reporting this information. You wanted to make it as factual as possible, as few adjectives as possible, simply to allow the information to be literally weighty and have an impact in that way. And you know, Human Rights Watch created its film festival in a way because it wanted to try to have a different way of also reaching people about those issues. It didn't want to change the reporting style or the presentation of the reports, but it wanted to have another method of trying to reach people, and so the film festival became the instrument for doing that. Don't change the reports, but also sponsor the film festival, which has itself, you know, caught on in many other places. That is, the Human Rights Watch film festival itself doesn't only take place in New York, and there are now human rights film festivals all over the world. Everybody seems to be sponsoring them these days.
And I would say, by the way, that people like you or like the two of us, when we're telling a story, there invariably comes a point where we need to pull back and say, now what's going on here? And we can at that point say, Human Rights Watch says this, 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 and put things in context with precisely because that exists. So I would absolutely credit that as a very important thing. It's just that at the end of the day, I just think people live in story. When I say adventures in the narrative, I mean not in narrative. I mean that we all live our lives in a narrative, and the narratives weave into each other.
We're about 15 minutes beyond the time that we said this would end. So I think I need to. I'm sorry. I think I need to bring it to a close at this point. But thank you very much, Lawrence Wechsler. Thank you very much, Tina Rosenberg. I thought it was a great conversation.
Thank you, Harry.